how to shape her shots became more conscious. She learned to articulate her reasons for choosing a specific f-stop, to not only find the settings that made it look right, but to explain why it looked right that specific way. 2 weeks into the semester, as the class began making their first prints, Pauline stopped by Mia's station in the dark room. In the glare of the red light, she looked as if she had been carved from a giant ruby. "How long have you been working with the view camera?" she asked. And when Mia told her, she said, "Would you like to show me some more of your photos?" The following Saturday, Mia found herself in the lobby of Pauline's apartment, an envelope of photos clutched in her hand. The building had a doorman, and Mia, having never encountered one before, was so awestruck she did not listen when he told her which floor, and resorted to pressing each button in the elevator in turn and checking the names on each door before ducking back inside and pressing the next. When she at last came out on the sixth floor, she found Pauline standing in the open doorway. "There you are," she said. "The doorman called up to say you were here 10 minutes ago. I was starting to wonder." She was barefoot, but otherwise looked exactly the same as she did in class. A black t-shirt and a long black skirt and long beaded earrings that jingled like chimes as she walked. Mia, blushing, followed her into a large, white-walled, sunlit room where everything seemed to glow. She had expected a photographer's apartment to be covered in photographs, but the walls were bare. Later, she would learn that Pauline's studio was upstairs, that she never hung anything because when she wasn't working, she wanted the white space. Palette cleanser, Pauline would explain. But at this moment, Mia simply sat down beside her on the nubbly gray couch, where they laid photograph after photograph across the coffee table. Pauline was full of questions, as she had been that second day of class. "Why did you set the camera so low in this one? Why so close in that one? Did you think about adjusting tilt here? What were you thinking about when you took this shot?" In the photographs, Mia lost her shyness. They were so engrossed that when a woman entered and set 2 cups of coffee down on the end table, one beside each of them, she jumped. "Mal," said Pauline with an offhand wave. "Mal, this is Mia Wright, one of my students." Mal was slender with long, wavy brown hair. She wore jeans and a green blouse, and like Pauline, she was barefoot. "Thought you'd like some coffee," Mal said. "Lovely to meet you, Mia." She kissed Pauline on the cheek and went away. Mia spent all afternoon there, until it was time for her shift at the bar. Pauline and Mal pressed her to stay for dinner until she finally admitted she had to go to work. "Then next week," Pauline suggested. "When you have a day off." Over the following months, she would visit Pauline and Mal often, talking photography with Pauline, watching her at work in her studio, listening to Pauline think aloud about whatever she was working on at the time. "I've been reading about ancient Egypt," Pauline might begin, flipping a book open. "Tell me what you think of this." At their dinner table, Mia tried foods she'd never tasted. Artichokes, olives, brie. Mal, she learned, was a poet, had published several collections of poems. "No one cares about poetry," Mal said with a rueful laugh. She lent Mia books by the stack. Elizabeth Bishop, Anne Sexton, Adrian Rich. By the time winter came, Mia would bring her newest photographs to show Pauline nearly every week, and they would talk them over, Pauline pressing her to articulate what she'd done and why. Before, Mia had taken photographs by feel, relying on instinct to tell her what was right and what was wrong. Pauline challenged her to be intentional, to plan her work, to make a statement in each photograph, no matter how straightforward the photo might seem. "Nothing is an accident," Pauline would say again and again. It was her favorite mantra, Mia had learned, in both photography and in real life. In Pauline and Mal's house, nothing was simple. In her parents' house, things had been good or bad, right or wrong, useful or wasteful. There had been nothing in between. Here, she found, everything had nuance. Everything had an unrevealed side or unexplored depths. Everything was worth looking at more closely. After these sessions, Pauline and Mal would always press Mia to stay for dinner. They knew by now about the three jobs, and Mal would urge extra servings on her, would send her home with Tupperware full of leftovers, which she would return on the next visit. They would, in fact, have encouraged her to stay the night, to settle into one of their guest rooms and stay for good if either of them could have thought of a way to suggest it. Because Mia was proud. This was quite obvious. Although she accepted their hospitality gratefully, after that first visit, she made a point of never arriving empty-handed. She brought them little things she had made, bunches of leaves gathered in Central Park and bound with a ribbon into a ruddy bouquet, a thumb-sized basket woven from grass. Once, a little sketch of the two of them she'd drawn in ink, even a handful of pure white pebbles after Pauline mentioned she'd begun a new project with stones. It was clear to both Pauline and Mal that these gifts eased Mia's guilt over all they offered her. Their food, their knowledge, their affection, and that otherwise Mia's pride would prevent her from coming back. And they very much wanted her to come back. By Christmas time, it had become clear to all of them, Pauline, Mal, and Mia's other teachers and fellow classmates, that Mia was immensely talented.
"You're going to be famous, you know that, right?"
Warren said to his sister one evening. She had come home for Christmas, and true to his word, he'd come to pick her up at the bus station in the little tan VW Rabbit he'd bought that fall. Now, 4 days after Christmas, he was bringing her back. Without discussing it, they had agreed to take the long route, along the winding back roads, in order to stretch out these last few minutes together. Warren was now a junior in high school, and it seemed to Mia that he'd grown in the time she was away. Not taller, but that something about him had deepened. His voice had lowered, and he'd begun to grow into his hands and fingers and feet, which for the past few years had been too large for him, like a puppy's paws. In the fading afternoon light, the stubble on his throat looked like only a shadow, but she knew it for what it was.
"We'll see," was all she said.
Then,
"And you? What are you going to be when you grow up?"
In kindergarten, when the teacher had asked this question, Warren had answered with his plans for that afternoon, the afternoon being as far into the future as his 5-year-old mind could imagine. Since then, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" had been their way of asking about plans for the day. And even now, Mia teased him, Warren never seemed to be able to look more than a week or two ahead.
"Tommy Flaherty and I are going hunting Friday," he said now. "Getting in one more trip before school starts." Mia made a face. She had never approved of hunting, though everyone in their neighborhood had a deer head or two somewhere in their houses.
"I'll call you when I get back," she said, and kissed him on the cheek. She was struck again by how he'd grown, how he seemed leaner and stronger and more solid than she'd remembered. She wondered if there was a girl in his life. What would he look like the next time she came home, she thought, and when would that be? Summer, perhaps, unless she got a job to save up for next year. There was so much to do. Already, in the few months since she'd come to New York, her work had developed. From her time with Pauline, from studying the work of her classmates, even from the long hours she'd put in at her many jobs and the constant rotation of strangers she encountered there. It had become smarter and more deliberate, more technically advanced and adventurous, riskier and edgier, and everyone, including Mia herself and Warren, waving to her through the passenger window before leaning over to crank it closed, was certain she would go far. Nothing was going to distract her from her work, she promised herself. The work was the only thing that mattered. She would not allow herself to think about anything else. She was so focused on her work that on the afternoon in March, when the man with the briefcase began staring at her, she did not notice right away. It was mid-afternoon when she got on at Houston Street, heading up to her job near Columbia, and the one was quiet, with only a handful of passengers. Mia was thinking about her project for Pauline, document a transformation over time, when she felt the sudden prickle on her skin that meant she was being watched. Mia was used to stares. This was New York, after all, and like all women, she had learned to ignore them, as well as the catcalls that sometimes accompanied them. But this man, she couldn't quite read. He seemed respectable enough.
neat striped suit, dark hair, briefcase between his feet. Wall Street, she guessed. The look in his eyes wasn't lust or even playfulness. It was something else. A strange mix of recognition and hunger. And it unsettled her. After three stops when the man had not stopped staring, she bundled up her things and stepped off at Columbus Circle. At first she thought she had lost him. The train pulled away and she settled herself on a grimy bench to await the next one, and then, as the handful of passengers cleared the station, she saw him again, briefcase in hand now, scanning the platform. Looking for her, she was sure. Before he spotted her, she turned and made for the staircase at the far end of the platform and followed the tunnel, walking as briskly as she could without attracting attention, to the platform for the sea. She'd be late for work now, but it didn't matter. She would get off in a stop or two and walk over to Broadway and catch the right train once she had gotten away, even if it meant paying another fare. When the sea came, Mia stepped onto a middle car and scanned the seats. The car was half full. Enough people that she could call for help if she needed, but not so full that the crowd would hide anything untoward. She settled herself into an empty seat in the center. At 72nd Street, there was no sign of him. But at 81st, just as Mia rose to leave, the door at the end of the car opened and in came the man with the briefcase. He was slightly disheveled now, a few locks of his hair falling into his face as if he'd been hurrying through the cars looking for her. Her eyes met his, and there was no way to pretend she hadn't seen him. Mia's roommate had been mugged twice, walking home late at night, and her classmate Becca had told her a man had pulled her into an alley off Christopher Street by her ponytail. She'd managed to fight him off, but he pulled out a hank of her hair. Mia had seen the bald spot. Whatever was going to happen would happen now, whether she stayed on the train or off. She stepped off the train, and he followed her. And when the doors closed, they stood frozen on the platform for a moment. There was no conductor or policeman in sight, only an old lady with a walker slowly trudging toward the stairs. And at the far end of the platform, a sleeping bum in tattered sneakers. If she ran, she thought, perhaps she could make it to the stairs before he caught her. "Wait," the man called as the train began to pull away. "I just want to talk to you. Please." He stopped and held up his hands. Now she could see that he was younger than she'd thought, perhaps only in his 30s, and thinner, too. His suit, she could see, was expensive, fine silver thread running through the wool, and his shoes were, too, cordovan with tassels and smooth leather soles, not the shoes of a man who ran. "Please," the man went on, "I'm sorry I followed you. I'm sorry I was staring at you. You must have thought..." He shook his head. "I don't like my wife riding the subway because I worry she'll get followed by someone just like that." "What do you want?" Mia croaked. She had not realized how dry her throat was. Behind her back, she tightened her grip on her keys, points out. "It doesn't look like much, but it'll hurt," Becca had told her. "Let me explain," the man said. "I'll stand right here. I won't come any closer. I just needed to talk to you." He put his briefcase down at his feet between them, and Mia relaxed an infinitesimal amount. If he tried to lunge at her now, it would trip him. His name was Joseph Ryan. Joey, he'd corrected himself, and he worked, as she'd guessed, on Wall Street. He'd rattled off a string of names that she recognized as one of the big trading firms. He and his wife lived over on Riverside Drive. He was headed home now. They'd been married for 9 years. They'd met as high school sweethearts. They didn't have any children. "We can't," Joseph Ryan explained. "She can't have children, and..." He stopped and looked at Mia beseechingly, ran a hand through his hair and took a deep breath, with the air of a man who knows he is about to utter something preposterous. "We've been looking for someone to carry a baby for us. The right person. And then, we would pay her, generously." Mia's head spun. She dug the points of her keys into the heel of her hand, not for protection now, but to convince her that what she was hearing was real. "You want..." she managed at last. "Why me?" Joseph Ryan fumbled in his pocket and produced a business card.
And after a brief hesitation, Mia took a single step forward and stretched her arm to take it.
"Please, will you just come and talk with us? Tomorrow, at lunch? Our treat, of course."
Mia shook her head. "I have to work," she said.
"I can't. Dinner, then. My wife and I can explain everything to you. Look, the Four Seasons. 7 o'clock? At the very least, I promise you'll get a good meal."
He bobbed his head like a shy schoolboy and picked up his briefcase.
"If you don't show up, I'll understand," he said. "I can't imagine having someone suggest this to you on a subway platform."
He shook his head. "But please, just think about it. You would help us so much. You would change our lives." And then he turned away and went up the staircase, leaving Mia standing on the platform, holding the card in her fingertips. For the rest of her life, Mia would wonder what her life would have been like if she had not gone to the restaurant that day. At the time, it seemed like a lark, just a way to satisfy her curiosity and get a nice meal in the bargain. Later, of course, she would realize it had changed everything forever. That evening, she stepped from 52nd Street into the lobby of the Four Seasons in the only nice dress she owned, one she'd worn to her cousin Debbie's wedding the year before. She'd grown since then, so the dress was a bit too short and a bit too tight, and even if it had fit, it would have been worlds of style away from this plush lobby, with its huge chandelier and its dense carpet and its jungle of potted plants. Even the air seemed lush and thick here, like velvet, swallowing up the click-click of ladies' heels and the chatter of men in suits, so that they passed as silently as gliding ships. Joseph Ryan had not told her where to meet them, so she stood awkwardly to one side, pretending to admire the painting that covered one of the lobby's enormous walls, trying to avoid the attention of the maitre d', who floated around the entrance of the dining room like a solicitous specter.
5 minutes, she thought, and if they didn't come, she would go home. She had forgotten to wear a watch, so she began to count slowly, as she and Warren had, as children playing hide-and-seek. She would count to 300. And then she would go home and forget this crazy thing had ever happened. And then, just as she reached 198, Joseph Ryan appeared at her elbow like a waiter.
"Picasso," he said.
"What?"
"The tapestry."
Here in the lobby he seemed almost bashful, and she had almost forgotten the menace she'd felt the day before.
"Well, not a tapestry per se, I guess. He painted it on a curtain. They asked him for a painting, but he didn't have time to make one, so he gave them this instead. I've always admired it."
"I thought you were bringing your wife," Mia said.
"She's at the table." He made as if to take her arm, then thought better of it and put his hands into his jacket pockets instead. It was almost comical. His gentlemanliness, she thought, as she followed him down the hallway. A huge white room with, she blinked, a jade-green pool in the center. Trees inside, studded with pink blossoms and starred with lights. Like a fairy forest, hidden in the center of a New York office building. All around the soft hum of conversation. A scrim of fine chains lacing the window, rippling like waves, though there was no breeze. And then the strange thing happened. As they came into the dining room, and Joseph Ryan approached the table in the corner, Mia saw herself, somehow already sitting at the table, in a neat navy dress, a cocktail in her hand. For a moment, Mia thought she was approaching a mirror, and she paused, confused. And then the woman at the table stood up and reached across to take Mia's hand.
"I'm Madeline," she said. And Mia had the uncanny sensation, as their hands met, of touching her reflection in a pool. The rest of the evening unfolded as if some kind of dream. Every time she looked at Madeline Ryan, she saw herself. They shared not just the curly dark hair and similar features, but some of the same mannerisms, the same tendency to bite their bottom lips, the same absent habit of pulling one curl down, like a spring, to their earlobes and letting it bounce back up. They were not identical. Madeline's chin was a bit more pointed, her nose a little thinner, her voice deeper, richer, almost throaty. But they looked so similar they could have been mistaken for sisters. Late that night, long after the taxi the Ryans had summoned had dropped her back at home, Mia sat awake, thinking over all she'd heard. How Madeline, at 17, had still not gotten her period, and how the doctor had then examined her and discovered that she had no uterus. 1 in 5,000 women, Madeline had explained. There was a long German name for it, Meyer-something syndrome, which Mia had not fully caught. How the only way for them to have a child was a surrogate. This was 1981, and 3 years before headlines had trumpeted the arrival of Louise Brown, the world's first test-tube baby. But the odds of such a birth were still poor, and most people still viewed brewing babies in petri dishes as suspicious. "Not for us," Madeline had said, twisting the stem of the wine glass between her elegant fingers. "No Franken-babies. No thank you." Instead, the Ryans had decided to take a more old-fashioned route, as old, Joseph pointed out, as the Bible. Sperm from the father, egg from, and carried by, a woman who seemed a suitable match. They had been advertising for months, discreetly, Madeline added, for a surrogate with the right characteristics, and had found no one. And then Joseph Ryan, riding the subway from a lunch meeting, had spotted an eerily familiar face at the other end of the car, and it had felt like fate. "We see it," he said, "as an opportunity for us to do each other some mutual good." He and Madeline glanced at each other, and Madeline gave him the merest nod of the head, and they both sat up a little straighter and turned to Mia, who set her fork down. "Don't think that we're entering into this lightly," Madeline said. "We've been thinking about this for a long time, and we've been looking for just the right woman." She tipped the carafe of water and refilled Mia's glass. "We think that woman is you." In her room now, Mia did calculations. $10,000 they had offered to carry a healthy baby for them. They had set this to her as if outlining the terms of a job offer, laying out the benefits package in the most attractive way. "And of course we'd pay for all your medical expenses," Joseph had added. At the end of the dinner, Joseph had slid a folded sheet of paper across the table. "Our home number," he said. "Think it over. We'll draw up a contract for you to look over. We hope you'll call us." He had already paid the bill, which Mia had not seen but knew must be appallingly high. They'd had oysters and wine. A tuxedoed man had prepared steak tartare at their table, deftly folding the golden yolk into the ruby-red meat. Joseph hailed Mia a taxi. "We hope you'll call," he said again. Behind him, behind the glass window of the lobby, Madeline buttoned the fur collar of her coat. Only after he had shut the door and the taxi was on its way back downtown to Mia's cramped apartment did she unfold the paper to see that astonishing figure again. $10,000. And below it, a single word. "Please." The next morning, she thought it was a bizarre dream until she saw that creased note still lying on her dresser. Insane, she thought. Her womb was not an apartment for rent. She could barely imagine having a baby, let alone giving one away. In the gray and steely morning light, the evening before now looked like a childish fantasy. She shook her head, dropped the note into her dresser drawer, pulled out her uniform for work. And then, a few weeks later, Mia learned her scholarship would not be renewed. Pauline and Mal opened the door, and without speaking she handed them a letter, slit jaggedly open by a finger. "Dear Miss Wright, we trust that you have been benefiting from your first year at the New York School of Fine Arts. However, we are sorry to inform you that due to funding restrictions, we are unable to continue your financial aid for the 1981 to 1982 academic year. We, of course, hope that you will nevertheless continue studies with us next year, and..." "They're idiots," Pauline said, tossing the letter onto the coffee table. "They have no idea what they're losing out on." "It's the state," Mal said. She retrieved the letter and slid it back into its envelope. "They cut funding, so the school has to cover more, and the scholarships suffer." "It's no big deal," Mia said. I'll get another job. I'll save up over the summer. As she rode the elevator back downstairs that evening, however, she rested her head against the mirrored wall and bit back tears. She could not take on more hours than she was already working, or she would have no time for her classes. And as it was, she was barely making ends meet. If she worked full-time all summer... She ran her mental calculations again. Unless she found a job that paid twice as much, she could not afford to stay.
"Are you all right, miss?" The elevator doors had opened, and there she was, back in the lobby, the kindly doorman peering down at her through his glasses. Behind him, a wine-colored carpet rolled all the way to the thick glass doors that sealed out Fifth Avenue. The lobby was hushed as a library, but beyond those doors, she knew, were the cracked concrete sidewalks and the rush and clamor and ruthlessness of the city.
"Fine," she said. They knew each other a bit now, as people in New York often do. His name was Martin, and he grew up in Queens and rooted for the Mets, not the Yankees, he told her. Never the Yankees. And had a dachshund at home named Rosie. For his part, Martin knew Mia's name and that she was the protégé of the lady artists upstairs, as he fondly referred to Pauline and Mal. And though Mia had told him little else about her life, his seasoned eye could divine quite a bit from the second-hand camera slung around her neck, the black-and-white uniform she sometimes still wore when she arrived, the containers of food she often carried home at Mal's insistence. He resisted the urge to pat her on the shoulder and pushed the front door open with one gloved hand.
"Have a good night," he said, and Mia stepped out onto Fifth Avenue and let the city swallow her up.
14. Mia did not consult her parents, or her roommates, or even Pauline and Mal. Looking back, she would realize this was proof that she had already made up her mind. The day after receiving the letter from the college, Mia broached the prospect of a raise with the manager of the diner.
"Wish I could, honey," he told her, "but I can't pay you girls more without raising prices and losing customers."
The manager of the Dick Blick said the same, and after that she didn't even bother to ask the bar owner. For a week, she dodged Pauline's repeated invitations to come for dinner. Mal, and probably Pauline as well, would sense her preoccupation right away. She sent a note to their apartment, in lieu of her usual Sunday visit, claiming she had the stomach flu and had to stay home. For a week, she thought only about her tuition, and the Ryans. She ruined an entire roll of film by pulling it out of the canister with the light on, something she'd never done before. She dropped a plate of eggs at the diner, sliced her finger on the jagged edge, watched a trickle of blood ooze onto the white china. Over and over during the day, she passed her hand across the flat plane of her belly, as if inside she might feel something that could give her clarity. One afternoon, on a break from work, she pulled Joseph Ryan's business card, the one he'd given her that first day, from her pocket, and headed to the subway. Perhaps he was a con man. How did she know these Ryans would pay what they promised, that they were even named Ryan? But indeed, the address on the card brought her to the gleaming glass building of Dyckman, Strauss, and Tanner on Wall Street. Mia hesitated outside the glass lobby for a few minutes, watching the reflections of the people on the sidewalk glide over and past the shadows of the people within. Then she pushed through the revolving door and to the row of phone booths that lined the lobby. She fed a dime into the slot and dialed the phone number on the card. In a moment, a female voice came on the line. "Dyckman, Strauss, and Tanner," the woman said. "Joseph Ryan's office. May I help you?" Mia hung up and hoisted the phone book onto her lap. There were six Joseph Ryans listed in Manhattan, but none on Riverside Drive. She let the phone book swing back on its chain and fished in her pocket for another dime. This time she called directory assistance, which provided her with an address. It was almost time for her shift at the bar to begin, but she took the train uptown anyway, and found herself outside a red brick pre-war building with a black awning and a doorman. Whoever lived here could certainly pay $10,000 for a child. The next afternoon, when Madeline Ryan came out of the building, Mia followed her, For an hour, she trailed her, all the way down 86th Street and around the neighborhood and back home. She saw how, on the way out of the building, Madeline Ryan nodded to the doorman as he swept the door open for her. How she paused on the sidewalk, turning back to say something that made the doorman smile, patting him gently on the forearm before heading on her way. How Madeline slowed when she passed women pushing strollers. How she smiled at the babies in those strollers, whether they were cheerful or fretful or sleeping. How she smiled and said hello to the women, asked how they were, commented on the weather. Even though Mia could see it, there was a deep hunger in her eyes. She rushed to open doors for these women, even the nannies pushing fair-skinned children, obviously not their own, holding the door open until woman and child were well into the bodega or the cafe or the bakery, before letting it swing slowly shut after them, with a wistful, almost mournful look. When a mother, harried in heels, clip-clopped past her, Madeline Ryan scooped up a pacifier thrown out of the stroller and raced after them to hand it over. Mia had never noticed before how many babies there were. They were everywhere. The city was simply crawling with them, the streets swarming with unabashed fecundity. And she felt a deep pang of pity for Madeline Ryan. Madeline Ryan stopped at a flower stall, bought a bundle of peonies wrapped in green tissue, the buds still balled in tight, hard fists. She headed toward home, and Mia let her go. In the end, she told herself it was the math that decided her. The Ryan's offer was enough to pay for 3 more terms of school. It would buy her time to earn enough money to pay for the rest. If she did this, she could continue. If she did not, she could not. Put that way, the choice seemed obvious, and she would be doing them a good turn. They were kind, sincere people. She could see that. How badly, she thought, they must want to have a child. She could help them. She would help them. She repeated this to herself, over and over, then lifted the receiver to dial their number. 3 weeks later, she was leaving an obstetrician with a letter certifying her good health, her freedom from contagious diseases, and her properly configured anatomy. "Perfect baby birthing hips," he had joked as she'd pulled her feet from the stirrups. "Everything in there looks fine. If you want to get pregnant, you shouldn't have any trouble." A week after that, she was applying for a 1-year leave of absence from school. And then just as April began and classes were winding down, she found herself in the guest room at the Ryan's elegant apartment. Madeline had purchased a beautiful pink terry robe for her. "Turkish cotton," she'd said, setting it on the bed with a pair of slippers. "We want to make sure you're comfortable." The bed had been made up with crisp white sheets, as if she were a cherished house guest. Outside, she could see the sun glint on the Hudson. Down the hall, she knew Joseph would be busy in the Ryan's own bedroom, preparing. There was a soft knock at the door, and Mia pulled the robe more tightly around herself. Her clothes sat folded neatly on the armchair in the corner. Madeline knocked again, then opened the door. "Are you ready?" she asked. In her hands was a wooden breakfast tray with a covered teacup and a turkey baster with a bright yellow bulb. She set it down on the bedside table, then, awkwardly, knelt and put her arms around Mia. "Thank you," she whispered. When Madeline had gone, Mia took a deep breath. Was she sure? She lifted the turkey baster from the tray. It was warm. Madeline must have rinsed it in hot water to take away the chill, she realized. And this small, generous gesture made her eyes fill. She lifted the lid from the cup, loosened the belt on the bathrobe, and lay back on the bed. A half an hour later, "You must keep your legs elevated for at least 20 minutes, Madeline had explained to her, "to increase the chances of conception." Mia emerged from the guest room to find Madeline and Joseph in the living room, holding hands. She had put her own clothes back on, but as they looked up at her in unison, eyes wide like nervous children, she had the sudden feeling of being naked. "It's done," she said, and patted the waist of her jeans. Madeline rose from the sofa in one fluid motion and clasped Mia's hand in hers.
"We can't thank you enough," she said. "Here's hoping it takes."
She set both of her palms on Mia's belly, as if offering a benediction, and Mia's muscles tensed and hardened.
"I'll call for the car. Joey can take you home," Madeline said. And then, "Of course we know it will take a few tries. This is going to take persistence for all of us. We'll see you again day after tomorrow."
Mia thought of the tray still sitting in the guest room, of Madeline rinsing the baster and the cup in the kitchen sink, readying them for their next use.
"Of course," she said.
"Of course." She was quiet all through the ride back to the village as Joseph Ryan chattered to her about how he and Madeline had met, where he'd grown up, the things they had planned for their child. All summer, this became the routine. The obstetrician had given her a chart to map out her most fertile periods, and during that week, she would visit the Ryans every other day. Then, the following week, she would wait, scanning her body for a sign. Each time she had backaches, headaches, cramps, and then, of course, no baby.
"It'll take a while," Madeline said as July came to a close.
For 4 months now, no luck.
"We always knew this. It doesn't happen right away."
But Mia was worried. According to the contract they'd signed, the Ryans were free to call off the agreement after 6 months if no pregnancy resulted. She had kept her jobs at the diner and the bar and the art store, and had dodged questions from her fellow students back from their summers off, buying supplies for the new term, wondering why she wasn't coming back.
"I'm taking a year off to earn money," she'd said, which was true, and what she had told Pauline and Mal when, tactfully, they'd hinted at offering her a loan she was too proud to accept. But she knew, too, that if no baby arrived, she would get nothing, and she would have dropped the entire year for nothing, and her leave of absence would likely become permanent. And then, in September, she waited and waited, and nothing happened. No blood, no cramps, just an intense feeling of fatigue, an overwhelming desire to crawl into bed and burrow beneath the comforter like a cat. Madeline nearly danced with delight when 2 days later, Mia arrived at her apartment feeling the same way. She bundled Mia into her coat, as if Mia herself were a child, and herded her into the elevator, then into a taxi to a pharmacy in Broadway. From a bewildering array of boxes with confident names, Predictor, Fact, AccuTest, she selected one and pressed it into Mia's hands. The test, it turned out, was complicated. It involved a glass test tube in a special holder, suspended over an angled mirror. Mia was to add several drops of her urine and wait for an hour. If a dark ring formed, she was pregnant. She and Madeline sat in silence for 45 minutes, side by side on the edge of the bathtub, and then Madeline suddenly took Mia's hand. "Look," she whispered, leaning toward the vanity, and Mia saw, in the little mirror, an iron-colored bullseye slowly appearing.
From then on, things changed quickly. Mia's roommates did not notice anything until she began throwing up in the bathroom.
"Sweet gig," one of them said. The other said, "I wouldn't go through all that, not for $1 million."
Weeks passed. The Ryans moved her to a little studio apartment they owned, a quiet walk-up just off West End Avenue.
"We rent it out, but the tenants just left," Madeline said to Mia. "Quieter for you. More space. Fewer people coming and going, and you'll be so much closer to us for when things start happening."
Mia quit her job at the art store, her belly was starting to show, but kept her other jobs, though she allowed the Ryans to linger under the impression that she had stopped working. After every doctor's appointment, she came by to give them the latest updates, and as her clothes began to tighten, the Ryans presented her with new ones.
"I saw this dress," Madeline would say, handing Mia a tissue-lined shopping bag with a flowered maternity dress inside it. "I thought it would look perfect on you."
She was, Mia realized, buying Mia the maternity clothes she would have bought herself, and she smiled and accepted them, and wore the dress on her next visit. She said nothing to her parents about any of this. She told them only, as Christmas approached, that she would not be coming home. "Too expensive," she claimed, knowing they would never ask her about school if she didn't bring it up. And they didn't. But at the end of January, she finally told Warren the truth.
"You never talk about class anymore," he said on the phone one evening.
She was 5 months along by then, and though she could have kept it from him, how would he ever know? She didn't like the thought of hiding it from him any longer. "Ren, promise you won't tell Mom and Dad," she'd said, taking a deep breath. Afterward, there was a long silence on the phone. "Mia," he'd said, and she knew he was serious because he never used her full name. "I can't believe he would do something like this."
"I thought it through," Mia set one hand on her belly where she had recently begun to feel faint flutterings.
"The quickening," Madeline had called it, as she laid her hands on Mia's skin. Such an old-fashioned euphemism, one that made her think of Quicksilver, a lithe little fish whipping about within her. "They're such good people, kind people. I'm helping them out, Ren. They want this baby so much, and they're helping me, too. They've done so much for me."
"But don't you think it's going to be hard to give it up?" Warren asked. "I don't think I could do it."
"Well, you're not the one doing it, are you?"
"Don't get pissy with me," Warren said. "If you'd asked me, I'd have told you not to."
"Just don't tell Mom and Dad," Mia said again.
"I won't," Warren said at last. "But I'll tell you this. I'm the baby's uncle, and I don't like it."
There was an anger in his voice she had never heard before, at least not directed at her. After that, she and Warren didn't speak for a while. Every week when she thought about calling him, she decided not to. Why call and argue again, she reasoned. In a few months, the baby would be born, she would go back to her old life, and things would be as they had been. "Don't get attached," she said to her belly when the baby nudged her with a foot. It was never clear to her, even then, whether she was speaking to the baby, or to her belly, or to herself. She and Warren were still not speaking when her mother called, very early in the morning, to tell her about the accident. It had been snowy, this much she knew. He and Tommy Flaherty had been coming home late at night. Where they'd been, her mother hadn't said, and they'd taken a turn too fast, and Tommy's Buick had skidded and then overturned. Mia would not remember the details, that the roof of the car had been crushed in, that the emergency workers had had to cut the Buick open like a tin can, that neither Warren nor Tommy had been wearing their seatbelts. She would not remember, at least for a while, about Tommy Flaherty in his hospital bed, with a punctured lung, a concussion, and 7 broken bones, even though he'd grown up just up the hill from them, even though he and Warren had been friends for years, even though he'd once had a crush on her. She would remember only that Warren had been driving, and that now he was dead. A plane ticket was expensive, but she couldn't bear the thought of waiting, even an extra few hours. She wanted to be swallowed up by the house where she and Warren had grown up and played and argued and planned, where he no longer waited for her, which he would never enter again. She wanted to sink to her knees at the spot on the cold roadside where he had died. She wanted to see her parents, to not have to sit alone with a terrible numbness that threatened to swallow her up. But when she stepped out of the taxi from the airport and came in the front door, her parents froze, staring at the bulge in her belly, which had grown too big for her to zip her coat. Mia's hand drifted down to her waist, as if one palm could hide what was growing there. "Mom," she said, "Dad, it's not what you think." A long silence unspooled in the kitchen, like gray ribbon. Hours and hours, it felt to Mia.
"Tell me," her mother said at last. "Tell us what we think."
"I mean," Mia looked down at her belly, as if she herself were bewildered to find it there. "It isn't my baby." Inside, the baby gave a fierce kick.
"What do you mean it isn't your baby?" her mother said.
How can it not be your baby?
I'm a surrogate. I'm carrying it for this couple.
Mia found herself trying to explain about the Ryans, about how kind they were, how much they wanted a baby, how happy they would be. She tried to focus on how much she was helping them, as if this were a charitable deed, purely altruistic, like volunteering at a soup kitchen or adopting a dog from a shelter. But her mother understood immediately.
"These Ryans," she said, "I suppose you're doing this for them just out of the goodness of your heart?"
"No," Mia admitted. "They're paying me when the baby's born." She realized suddenly that she was still wearing her scarf and hat. A thin gray sludge trickled from her boot treads onto the cream-colored linoleum. Her mother turned and headed for the doorway.
"I can't cope with this now," she said, her voice fading as she stepped into the living room.
"Not now." At the foot of the staircase, she stopped and hissed with a venom that shocked Mia.
"Your brother is dead. Dead. You realize that? And you come home like this?"
Footsteps pounded up the steps. Mia glanced at her father. She felt exactly as she had as a child when she'd broken something or ruined something or spent on film the money that her mother had meant for clothes. In those moments, her mother would rage and scream and run to her room, leaving Mia with her father, who would squeeze her hand and let the quiet lap over them like milk, then say quietly, "Buy a new one," or "Give her an hour and go apologize," or sometimes simply, "Fix it." This was how they'd always fought. But this time her father did not take her hand. He did not say to her, "Fix it." Instead, he looked at her belly, as if he couldn't bear to look at her face. His eyes were wet and his jaw clenched. "Dad?" she said at last. She would have preferred shouting to this protracted, knife-sharp silence.
"I can't believe you'd sell your own child," he said,
and then he, too, left the room. They didn't tell her to leave, but even after she hung her coat in the hall closet, set her bag down in her old bedroom, they didn't speak to her. At dinner, she sat at her old place at the table, and her mother set a plate and fork in front of her, and her father passed the casserole that one of their neighbors had brought. But they said nothing to her. And when she asked questions, when was the funeral going to be? Had they seen Warren? They answered as briefly as possible. Mia gave up eventually and wound noodles and tuna around her fork. There was a whole stack of casseroles in the fridge, a leaning tower of Pyrex baking dishes crimped in foil. As if no one knew what to do in the face of such tragedy except to make the heaviest, heartiest, most prosaic dish they could. To give the bereaved something solid to hold on to. None of them mentioned or looked at Warren's empty place by the window. They decided everything without her. What the flowers would be. What the music would be. What color coffin Warren would be placed in. Walnut, with a blue silk lining. They suggested, tactfully, that Mia not go out. She must be tired, they said. They didn't want her to slip on the ice. But she understood. They didn't want the neighbors to see her. When Mia picked out a shirt and tie for Warren, the one he always chose when forced to dress up, her mother selected another, the white shirt and red-striped tie that she'd bought Warren when he entered high school, which he'd said made him look like a stockbroker, and which he never wore. At no point did they mention her interesting condition or her complicated situation. But when they said it would be best if she didn't attend the funeral, "We just don't want anyone getting the wrong idea," her mother had put it. Mia gave in. The night before the funeral, she packed her things. From the back of the closet, she pulled her old duffel bag and took the quilt from her bed, a few old blankets. Then she tiptoed across the hall into Warren's room. His bed was still unmade. She wondered if her mother would ever make it again, or if she'd simply strip the sheets, strip the room, paint it white, and pretend nothing had ever happened there. What would they do with Warren's things, she wondered. Would they give him away?
Would they pack them into crates in the attic to grow musty and faded and old? On Warren's bulletin board, she spotted the photo from her art school application. The etched-in image of the two of them, children, climbing up the mountain of slag. She unpinned it and added it to her bag. Then on his desk, she found what she'd been looking for. The keys to Warren's car. Her parents were asleep. Her mother had been taking sleeping pills at night to calm her nerves, and the crack beneath their bedroom door was dark. The rabbit started up with a throaty growl. "A Porsche purrs," Warren had told her once. "A VW kind of puts." She had to pull the front seat all the way forward to reach the clutch. His legs had always been longer than hers. Then she pressed down on the gear shift, and after a moment of hunting, fiddled her way into reverse, and the darkened house faded in her headlights as the car backed out of the driveway. She drove all night and reached the Upper West Side as the sun was rising. She'd never had to park in Manhattan before, and circled the neighborhood for 10 minutes before squeezing into a spot on 72nd Street. In her apartment, she sank into her borrowed bed and wrapped herself in the quilt. It would be a long time, she knew, before she would sleep in a bed this comfortable again. When she woke, the late afternoon sun was already sinking over the Hudson, and she got to work. Only the things she'd brought with her, that were truly hers, went into her bag. Her too tight clothes, the handful of loose muumuus she'd bought herself at Goodwill, a few old quilts, some faded bedsheets, a handful of silverware, a file box of negatives, and her cameras. The fancy maternity dresses from the Ryans she folded neatly and placed in a paper grocery bag. Once she'd finished, she sat down with a pen and a piece of paper. She'd been thinking about what to say all the long drive from Pittsburgh, and in the end, she decided to lie. "There is no easy way to say this," she wrote. "I lost the baby. I'm so ashamed and so sorry. You don't owe me anything from our agreement, but I feel I owe you. Here is money to pay you back for the medical appointments. I hope it's enough. It's all I can spare." She placed her note on top of a stack of bills, $900 of her saved-up wages. Then she bundled them into the bag with the maternity dresses. The regular doorman was off duty that night, and with Mia's coat nestled around her, the night doorman didn't seem to notice her belly. He accepted the parcel for the Ryans without once glancing at her face, and Mia headed back to the rabbit, parked several blocks away. In her belly, the baby kicked once, then turned over, as if settling into sleep. She drove all night, through New Jersey and Pennsylvania, miles of highway whipping by in the dark. As the sun began to rise, she turned off the highway just outside Erie and drove until she found a quiet, rural road. Once she'd parked well off the roadside, she locked all the doors, climbed into the back seat, and wrapped herself in her old quilt. She'd expected it to smell like detergent, like home, and she braced herself for a whirl of nostalgia. But the quilt, having lain on her bed untouched for the past year, smelled like nothing. Not clean, not dusty, no smell at all. And pulling it over her head to shield her eyes from the sun, Mia fell asleep. All week she drove this way, as if in a fever, driving until exhaustion forced her to stop, sleeping until she was rested enough to drive again, ignoring the clock, the light and dark of each day. She stopped now and then when she passed a town to buy bread, peanut butter, apples, to refill the gallon jug in the passenger seat with water at a fountain. Throughout her belongings she had hidden $2,000, saved up from her tips and wages since she'd come to New York. In the box of negatives, in the glove compartment, in the right cup of her bra. Ohio, Illinois, Nebraska, Nevada. And then suddenly, the teeming swirl of San Francisco, the Pacific churning blue-gray and white before her, and she could go no further. What else was there to know? Mia found an apartment, a room for rent in the Sunset, in a house whose plaster was the color of sea salt, with a stern and elderly landlady who eyed her stomach and asked only, "There going to be an angry husband knocking on my door in a week?" For the last 3 months of her pregnancy, Mia walked the city, circling the lagoon in Golden Gate Park, climbing Coit Tower, one day crossing the Golden Gate Bridge in a fog so dense she could hear, but not see, the traffic rushing alongside her. The fog mirrored her state of mind so perfectly she felt as if she were walking through her own brain. A haze of formless, pervasive emotion. Nothing she could grasp, but full of looming thoughts that appeared from nowhere, startling her, then receded into whiteness again before she was even sure what she had seen. Mrs. Delaney, her landlady, never smiled at her when they passed each other in the hallway, or when they happened to meet in the kitchen. But as the weeks went on, Mia would often come home to find a plate in the oven, a note on the counter that read, "Had leftovers. Don't want to waste them." When Pearl was born, on an unseasonably warm May afternoon, at the hospital after 14 hours of labor, Mia took the birth record card from the nurse. She had been thinking for months now about what to name this child, mentally combing through all the people she'd known, the books she'd read in high school. Nothing had seemed right until she remembered the scarlet letter, and the right name came to her at once. Pearl. Round, simple, whole as the peal of a bell. And, of course, born into complicated circumstances. Beside it, on the line for mother's name, she wrote in neat letters, Mia Warren. Then she'd reached into the bassinet beside her bed and taken her daughter into her arms. The first night back in the rented room, Pearl had cried and cried until Mia herself had begun to cry. She wondered if, in New York City, the Ryans would still be awake in their gleaming apartment. What they would say if she lifted the phone and said to them, "I lied. The baby is here. Come and get her." They would take the next flight and arrive at her door, she knew, ready to spirit Pearl away. She could not tell if the thought was terrible or tempting or both. And she and Pearl both wailed. Then there was a soft knock at the door, and stern Mrs. Delaney appeared and held out her arms. "Give her here," she said, with such authority that Mia handed the soft bundle over without thinking. "Now you lie down and get some rest," Mrs. Delaney said, shutting the door behind her. And in the abrupt silence, Mia flopped down on the bed and fell instantly asleep. When she woke, she came bleary-eyed into the kitchen, then into the living room where Mrs. Delaney sat in a pool of lamplight, rocking a sleeping Pearl. "Did you rest?" she asked Mia, and when Mia nodded, she said, "Good," and set the baby back into Mia's arms. "She's yours," Mrs. Delaney said. "You take care of her." She spent the next few weeks in the same haze, but something had begun to shift. Mrs. Delaney never again came to take the baby away, no matter how hard Pearl cried. But in the evenings, she would rap on the door with a bowl of soup, a cheese sandwich, a piece of meatloaf. Leftovers, she always claimed. But Mia understood the gift for what it was. And understood, too, when Mrs. Delaney followed these offerings with a gruff, "Rent's due Thursday." Or, "Don't track mud into the hall." What she was trying to say. Pearl was 3 weeks old, still old mannish, squash-faced, and the fog was just beginning to lift when Mal's phone call arrived. Mia had sent Pauline and Mal a letter once she'd settled, with her new address and phone number. "I'm fine," she told them, "but I won't be coming back to New York. Here's where you can reach me if you need to." And now Mal had needed to reach her. A few weeks ago, Pauline, it seemed, had started having headaches. Strange symptoms. "Auras," said Mal. "She said I looked like an angel, with a halo all around me." A scan had found a lump the size of a golf ball in her brain. "I think," Mal said after a long pause, "if you want to see her, maybe you should come right away." That evening, Mia booked a plane ticket, the second she'd ever bought. It took most of her savings, but a bus across the country would take days. Too long. She arrived at Pauline and Mal's apartment with a knapsack slung over her shoulder and Pearl in her arms. Pauline, 20 pounds thinner, looked like a more concentrated version of herself, whittled down somehow, pared down to her essence. They spent the afternoon together, Mal and Pauline cooing over the baby, and Mia spending the night, for the first and last time, in their guest room with Pearl beside her. In the morning, she woke